Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warns regional war will break out if Israel keeps desecrating the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Muslims' third holiest site. Israeli forces arrest two Palestinians in connection with the death of an Israeli guard in the occupied West Bank. French President Emmanuel Macron says his country will increase military and humanitarian support for Ukraine as Russia escalates its warnings and criticism. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in for World News. And now, leader of Hamas in the besieged Gaza Strip has warned Israel about the consequences of desecrating Palestinian sanctities, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
This means one thing, that the enemy wants to turn this war and this battle into a religious battle. We prefer that the battle not turn into a religious battle. But if the heads of the occupation and its extremists want to turn it into a religious battle, we're all for it, and we accept the challenge.
Yahya Sinwar noted defending Palestinian holy sites, particularly the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is the responsibility of resistance groups and the Palestinian nation. The Hamas leader also said the Palestinians' recent operations inside occupied territories revealed Israel is weaker than a spider's web. He made the remarks during a speech commemorating International Quds Day. Hamas official also slammed as traitors Arab states that are seeking to normalize ties with Israel. Israeli forces have arrested the suspected killers of a settlement guard shot in an attack in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military says the suspects were arrested in a village after a day-long manhunt. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the armed wing of the Fatah faction, claimed responsibility for the shooting. The group said the attack was in response to violations committed by the regime in Al-Quds. Regime forces also killed a Palestinian in an operation they claim was linked to the hunt for the attackers. That's after dozens of people hurt in Israeli attacks at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Unrest came on the last Friday of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan and brought to nearly 300 number of Palestinians injured over a two-week period in clashes at the site. Political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says the Israeli regime is losing its grip in occupied territories amid the recent increase in Palestinian operations there.
Well, increasingly, you're seeing the Israeli forces acting in a kind of very, very reactionary manner. You're seeing them get more and more anxious, more and more fearful. And a lot of their strategies they give off the air of desperation. This incident sounds like just one of those realities because they're losing grip. Not only are they losing grip in terms of their military dominance and the narrative that they had about invincibility with the Iron Dome, their much vaunted Israeli high-tech army. Of course, all of these myths have gradually and steadily been eroded through the victories of the Islamic resistance. They've done it steadily in Israel. They've done it across the borders in Lebanon. Hezbollah's been responsible there. And more latterly, we've seen the Palestinian resistance grow a real backbone. And it's the military armed resistance combined with on-the-ground uprising.
The French president says his country will step up military and humanitarian support for Ukraine as Russia escalates its warnings and criticism. Emmanuel Macron made the announcement in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky. Now, since Russia launched war against Ukraine, NATO members and allies have provided billions of dollars in military support to Kiev. Supplied weapon systems range from surface-to-air missiles to heavy artillery and surveillance equipment. The U.S. alone has provided over $3 billion in aid, and in a vast increase to that aid, the U.S. president is now calling on Congress to allocate another $33 billion in mostly military assistance to Ukraine. Now, Moscow says the aid only fuels the conflict and also risks a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. It's also warned any attempt to interfere in the war will be met with a swift response. Russia says dialogue between Moscow and Washington on strategic stability is frozen now. Director of Russian Foreign Ministry Department of Non-Proliferation says contacts could resume after Russia completes its offensive in Ukraine. Vladimir Yermakov warned plans by the U.S. to deploy medium and small-range missiles in Europe will fuel an arms race and worsen the situation. The top diplomat noted the risks of nuclear war need to be kept to a minimum. Yermakov also said nuclear powers must adhere to an agreed framework aimed at preventing nuclear war. Tensions have escalated between Russia and the West since Moscow launched war on Ukraine in late February. And now a new bomb attack has hit the Afghan capital, Kabul, killing a woman. Spokesman for Kabul's commander says three others were also wounded after a passenger van exploded in the city. There's no claim of responsibility for the bombing yet, but the Daesh terrorist group has claimed similar attacks in the past. Incident comes a day after an explosion killed some 50 worshippers after Friday prayers in a Kabul mosque. The country has increasingly been hit by terrorist attacks. This has raised security fears on the eve of Eid al-Fitr on Sunday, a religious occasion marking the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Afghanistan, once again facing waves of deadly attacks. In the latest incident, a powerful explosion hit Khalifa Sahib Mosque in the capital Kabul, killing and injuring dozens of worshippers.
Every Friday, people come to the mosque to say their prayers. Hearing the bomb explosion, I entered the mosque. I am shocked as I'm talking. We took more than 200 casualties to the hospital. It was so horrifying that I had never witnessed such a scene.
Previously, we were falling victim to the US and Taliban war. However, the situation has now changed, but we're still being killed in the mosques and schools. We don't know who are carrying out such blind attacks, but I'm sure the attackers are not Muslims.
Exhausted by growing violence, people of Afghanistan are calling for an end to terror attacks and punishment for the perpetrators.
In my opinion, the recent attacks on specific groups and places show that the enemies of the people of Afghanistan are trying to sow sedition among Muslims and impose another proxy war on Afghans. The Taliban, as new rulers, are obliged to protect Afghans and bring the terrorists to justice.
The international community should take action in ending violence in Afghanistan. They know the roots of terrorist groups or criminal bonds. They should help Afghans with practicing a stability. If they are voicing human rights, so why they are watching us falling victim to terrorism?
In the recent days, several large bomb attacks targeted public places in the capital Kabul, Mazar-i Sharif, and Kunduz provinces. The attacks have taken a scores of lives, mostly from the Hazara community. Bomb attacks in Afghanistan continue as Afghans are observing the holy month of Ramadan. People here believe their enemies are missing new chance to harm innocent Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran observes a Persian Gulf National Day commemorating a historical victory over foreign invaders in the southern waters over four centuries ago. To mark this occasion, the Iranian flag was raised on domestically built destroyer, the Jamaran, in the country's southern waters. Every year, Iranians observe the Persian Gulf Day on the 10th of Ordibehesht, the second month of the Persian calendar, which usually falls on April 29th or 30th. The date coincides with the anniversary of a military campaign in the 17th century when the Iranian forces drove the Portuguese navy out of the Strait of Hormuz. The national occasion is aimed at calling attention to not only the historical victory, but also the very fact the true name of the inland sea has always been the Persian Gulf. Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted the longest iftar table event, offered free Ramadan dinners to thousands of people, mostly from the less privileged stratum of society. Yusuf Jalali reports.
This iftar table stretches for 5 kilometers. Organized by Tehran's Grand Bazaar, the event served iftar to over 5,000 people, mostly low-income families. Organizers say it is the longest iftar spread ever hosted in the world.
I'm honored to have the chance to host my fellow citizens for an iftar dinner. The Grand Bazaar of Tehran started this initiative with the aim of helping the less privileged. Throughout the year, we launch many charity initiatives, but its climax is in Ramadan, because it is the month of kindness.
This is the second time Tehran's Grand Bazaar hosts such a large-scale iftar meal as a charity gesture. The benefactors who contributed to the event say Ramadan is a time to push the limits on humanity and put a smile on the faces of the needy.
It's so beautiful when you see the rich and the poor sit around the same iftar spread and break their Ramadan fast. I'm so happy to be a part of this, and I hope such humanitarian gestures will be promoted to hopefully root out poverty.
Every year in Ramadan, charity works get supercharged, with Muslims trying to pitch in to have a say in helping the poor, as they believe Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking, but it's a time for sharing love and kindness with fellow human beings.
With all its beautiful celebrations like this large iftar party, Ramadan is about to come to an end. But organizers say what's important is to learn the lessons of Ramadan on the beauty of kindness and togetherness, which if practiced, the world would be a better place to live. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Veteran Iranian movie producer, director, and researcher Nader Talibzadeh has passed away at the age of 69. His career featured a range of thought-provoking productions and outstanding activities. This following report briefly introduces some of his work by this renowned movie director.
Nader Talibzadeh is a familiar name not only to most Iranians, but to many overseas. He was known for his unique documentaries and programs, producing numerous award-winning movies. As an independent filmmaker, Talibzadeh directed several documentaries about the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. His documentaries featured the resistance of Iranian forces as well as the ravages of war, which were a legacy of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's aggression against Iran. Talibzadeh also made a documentary about alleged Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, banned weapons that the U.S. claimed Saddam's regime possessed and based on that claim invaded the Arab country in 2003. In 2007, Talibzadeh produced his first feature-length movie titled The Messiah. It depicts the life and teachings of Jesus from an Islamic perspective and based on the Holy Quran. His research for the movie spanned an entire decade. Also a TV presenter, Talibzadeh wrote and hosted a talk show dubbed The Secret for Press TV. Furthermore, he was the chairman of the International New Horizon Conference. That's an annual event serving as a platform for denouncing U.S. and Israeli policies. Talibzadeh was blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington for organizing the conference.
I loved Nader very deeply. He was like an uncle to me. I cherished his memory, and I was so honored to have been invited to the New Horizons Conference.
It's one of the great ironies of being in Iran and meeting all these fantastic people invited to Iran by Nader Talibzadeh, that we were experiencing, you know, free speech. I hadn't really appreciated how censored and how narrow our discussions were in North America among fellow academics, how censored we were until I got to Iran. And the fact that we were engaging in free speech and free commentary on some of the most forbidden subjects in the world.
During his career, Talibzadeh also organized several film festivals, taught at an Islamic movie-making institute, and served as the manager of a Center for Cinematic Research and Studies. Recently, he suffered from ill health. Talibzadeh had been in hospital for some time before he succumbed to complications of heart disease on the 29th of April, 2022.
Islamophobia is on the rise around the world, but the most violent attacks on Muslims are being carried out in the West, such as in the U.S. In the meantime, calls are growing to address a long-running discrimination and hatred against the faith group.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, describe Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government's institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on.
Now, according to the Council on American-Islamic Relations, over $100 million was funneled into 26 Islamophobia network groups between 2017 to 2019. An earlier study had put the figure at some $1.5 billion. Now, that makes Islamophobia a considerably lucrative industry. So who's behind such activities, and what's their end game? And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Boris Johnson's stories, like Nixon's Republicans, have become synonymous with falsehood and corruption, says Peter O'Born, columnist, in an article titled Boris Johnson, just like Richard Nixon, will be brought down by vanity. Stay tuned for more. Ego destroyed Richard Nixon. Searching for control over all his subordinates and over history's verdict on his administration, the U.S. president installed a tape machine to record his every word. This proved his downfall. Once the existence of the tapes was known, Nixon's opponents fought a court battle to force the White House to release them. Then the Supreme Court ordered him to release the tapes. They included the famous smoking gun tape, which documented Nixon and his chief of staff, Bob Heidelman, plotting the Watergate cover-up. Thereafter, impeachment became inevitable and Nixon was finished. History repeats itself, the first time as tragedy, the second as farce. Nixon, the president who ended the Vietnam War and went to China, was a momentous historical figure. By comparison, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is negligible, except that he too faces the prospect of being brought down by ego. In order to build the personality cult that has defined his premiership, Johnson hired three taxpayer-funded photographers. Their official purpose was to document the work of government. Their unstated purpose was to control and massage the public image of the Prime Minister and his entourage, with approved shots issued free of charge to a grateful client media showing Johnson industriously studying his papers in conversation with foreign leaders and doing other statesman-like work. An early example of the genre was a widely used portrait of the Prime Minister's dog, Dylan, frolicking in the snow, completely irrelevant to government, by softening the Prime Minister's public image. Recently, these photographers have suddenly become a deadly problem. They are no longer simply a cheerful addition to the numbers and publicity machine. They possess photographic evidence that has the power to destroy Johnson's premiership. The Sunday Times reported this weekend that Johnson personally instigated a Downing Street party on November 13, 2020, to mark the exit of Lee Kane, the former number 10 director of communications. At this party, in an account that has been challenged by Downing Street, Johnson reportedly made a speech, poured alcoholic drinks for guests, and drank alcohol himself. Crucially, one of Johnson's snappers was reportedly present and took photographs. It should be stressed for the benefit of readers who are understandably confused by the so-called Partygate saga that this was a different event from the birthday party in June 2020 for which the Prime Minister has already been fined for breaking COVID rules. We are talking about another party and a separate police investigation. If these weekend reports are true, they are lethal for Johnson for two reasons. Firstly, because the alleged infraction, namely that he instigated the party himself and poured drinks, is more serious. Secondly, because Johnson is on the record as stating the party never took place. This denial is especially meaningful because it took place in the House of Commons. Asked at Prime Minister's questions in December whether there had been a party on November 13, 2020, Johnson replied no, but added, "I'm sure that whatever happened, the guidance was followed at all times." The denial can be seen on video here. If the Prime Minister was lying, parliamentary convention demands that he should resign, though it is generally accepted that Johnson, if nothing else, a fighter, will refuse to do so and will battle to the end. It is now plain that Britain has to deal with a venal and immoral prime minister. Lord Hansey, Britain's most celebrated constitutional historian and normally the mildest of men, was driven to speak out. Using extraordinary language, he labeled Johnson a rogue prime minister, adding that he had sullied his office like no other, turning it into an adventure playground for one man's narcissistic vanity. For good measure, he declared that the Queen's first minister is unworthy of her, her parliament, her people, and her kingdom. He added, "I cannot remember a day when I've been more fearful for the well-being of the Constitution." It's relevant to remember that Hansey supervised the PhD thesis of Britain's most senior civil servant, Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, today the Prime Minister's most senior official advisor. While we doubt that Hansey alerted the Cabinet Secretary to his astounding intervention, we are sure that Case agrees with it, because it's impossible to dispute what the constitutional historian said. It is easy to demonstrate that the Prime Minister is a rule breaker and utters falsehoods. It details more than 50 occasions when he has misled Parliament in defiance of the ministerial code, each occasion a resignation offence. Nothing like this has happened before any, under any Prime Minister of any political party. Today, Parliament returns. Johnson is booked to speak in person to Conservative MPs and appeal for their backing. He and his supporters will argue that it would be wrong to get rid of him while war ravages in Ukraine. They will laud Johnson's shambolic and probably illegal plan to export refugees to Rwanda as a popular measure that will win public support. Behind the scenes, Johnson's enforcers will, as usual, seek to threaten, blackmail, and bribe MPs. We expect these tactics will work and Johnson will survive for the time being. But there is another parallel between Johnson and Nixon. The Watergate tapes made Nixon's defenders look increasingly stupid in their own.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, discussing the concept of fasting and the spirit of fasting, our two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Sajjad Haider. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
And Brother Sajjad Haider, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to discuss the topic, why do Muslims celebrate a happy occasion, Eid al-Fitr, after the end of the month of Ramadan? After one fasting month, the Muslims have an Eid or celebration, a happy occasion in which they celebrate this holy month. But this type of celebration is very much different from the other ceremonies and the celebrations that are done in non-Islamic lands or the Western countries or something like that. The main philosophy behind this celebration, this is the main topic for today's discussion. Brother Sajjad Haider, let's start with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah. First of all, I want to point out that the times, you know, the time and the places, all are the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's no difference being that they are the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's no difference in this aspect. But still, there are points, there are hidden points, metaphysical points and other points regarding which some places and sometimes are spatial. So we are told that regarding this metaphysical or hidden aspect, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in many cases we know ourselves that some places and sometimes are spatial. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told us by revelation or by the narrations of Holy Prophet, we know that some places and sometimes are very spatial. Yes. And some the places or the times which are spatial, so in some, for example, regarding this Eid al-Fitr,
yes.
We are told by narrations and by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that this day is a spatial day. This is the day of happiness. So the first point about the happiness and why we celebrate this day because we are ordered, because it has been declared by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that it is the day of happiness. This is the first point,
okay.
That it has been told that it is a special day. This is the first point.
Okay.
The second point, it's the spiritual and the intellectual happiness that for the spiritual gain, intellectual mm-hmm. gain, which you have gained in this
achieved.
Month of, which you have achieved in the
yes.
month of Ramadan.
Yes.
So it's natural that a person who efforts and works hard for gaining a purpose, and when he reaches that goal, he becomes happy. So it has two of these aspects,
right.
That it has been told
yes.
by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
okay.
that it is a special time,
mm-hmm.
special time for being happy.
Okay.
And also the gain, the spiritual gain,
yes.
which we
okay.
have, which
Very
we
good.
Have achieved, so it makes us happy and celebrate this time.
Why is it called Eid al-Fitr? What does it mean by Fitr, Sayyid?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, when we talk about the day of Eid,
yes.
Why we celebrate it, Eid means some other happy day.
Yes.
And on the other hand, we know that this celebration is because, you know, when you stop someone
mm-hmm.
from performing something, for example, you stop a kid from entering into your room, yeah, you stop him for a couple of hours. After that, when you allow, what is the reaction of kid?
Mm-hmm.
He becomes happy.
Okay.
He comes and he jumps in your room.
Mm.
Yeah. Similarly, in the month of Ramadan, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has stopped us from eating and drinking, and that is the main concept of fast, obviously, the apparent concept
yes.
of fast, that you do not eat and drink. So on this day, after forbidding you during the daytime, and there are other things as well, obviously, which are forbidden. So on the day of Eid, when he lifts up this ban of eating and drinking during the day from the during that specific time, it's a kind of happiness. It brings
mm-hmm.
a happiness for a person. On the other hand, because the month of Ramadan was the month of being guest of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
yes.
according to the narration which we have from Imam Radha alayhi salam, he says that the Eid al-Fitr is the day on which we need to gather to the, you know, in the desert, and we need to have a gathering where
yes.
we all Muslims together are thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for such a gift
mm-hmm.
which has given. And on the other hand, obviously, there is another narration from Imam Sadiq that this is the day on which Allah, an angel, he calls people and he says, come and get your gifts that were given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
So that's why we have this.
This Zakat al-Fitriya, you mean? Is it the gift?
No, the gift is
okay.
the gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the reward
okay.
from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala
okay.
for the month that you have.
Uh-huh.
This is the day which you get.
Oh.
Obviously, on the prayers and the prayers of this
yes.
day, even we have all these things
okay.
mentioned. So basically, this is the day where we have bid some hardness before it.
Yes.
We were patient on something.
Okay.
And now that ban is lifted.
Oh.
And now it's kind of happiness that it's
yes.
bringing. And on top of that, because we succeeded
mm-hmm.
to obey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there is a gift for us.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other concepts about the Eid as well, because Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has said that any day on which you do not perform any kind of sin is the day of Eid for you.
Eid for you, that's right.
It's the day of happiness for you,
okay.
for example. So the day of happiness is when you do not commit sin. Since we have stopped ourselves for the whole month,
mm-hmm.
then obviously this is the day to celebrate that we were able to manage to stop ourselves from committing any kind of sin and other sins. And now today we are celebrating the day as the day of Eid.
That's all right. The people are recommended and are ordered to give a kind of zakat on this day, isn't it? you know, Zakat al-Fitriya. And what does this concept show on this very day? You know, it is an Eid for you, a happy occasion, but you have to pay. Yeah. What does this payment show?
Zakat, which we pay at the end of this holy month, holy season, is actually about sharing. It's a kind of happiness. I didn't read this in any narration, but what I can express and reflect on this topic by saying this, that actually you, when you are happy, you want to share your happiness with the poor.
Uh-huh.
When you are happy, you want to express this happiness. So maybe this may be one of the causes.
Yes.
And also there may be another aspect, the hidden aspect, which you don't know. Any narration or ayah can tell that. But apparently what is apparent from this order is that you share your happiness by making someone also happy about the occasion which you are happy.
So after 1 month of being... hungry or something like that, at the end of the month, you're going to share, you know, from your own pocket, from your own money to the poor and to the destitute of the society. This is really...
thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Kind of thanking. Yes.
Thanking.
This is for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but for the society. I'm talking about the social benefits that the people might take out of this day.
Question which I did not answer. Like you
what was the meaning of fitr?
Fitr.
Yes.
Basically, when we say Eid has come from the word aud.
Yes.
To coming back returning.
Yes.
And fitr, someone has said, like it's from the fitra, which is innate. Coming back towards the fitra.
Oh.
No, Eid al-Fitr. Why? Because you have stopped yourself for the whole the month of the Ramadan. Your spiritually has gone back to the...
Very original,
yes.
Divinity.
So that's why we said, like, in the month of Ramadan, Allah forgives all the sins. And the nights of the Qadr is the night when the sins are forgiven.
Oh.
So basically, this is the date when you celebrate. Why we celebrate Eid al-Fitr is that we have come back to the origin or innate, which was made by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Eid al-Fitr, the out towards the fitrah.
Oh, really beautiful. I didn't think about it from this angle that you talked about it, you know. Yes, after 1 month of servitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then again you are getting back. And this is a new start, I think, too, okay?
Yes, it is definitely a new start.
A new start for entrance into the other days of your life after the holy months of Ramadan. That's all right. So what's this surur and this type of happiness?
Giving a touch to some philosophical aspect,
yes.
The classical philosophers like Aristotle, they say that always the fulfillment brings joy. For example, if you have a potential for something and this potential is activated, it becomes active, you get pleasure. You get joy. So materialistically, even speaking, or speaking about the real thing which happens in us. So even philosophically, that this happiness has a reason. That as the philosopher says, that because you have activated something in your souls, this potential has become activated, so naturally you will become happy. So this has their roots in other, you can give other examples for this, that any person who is, for example, who want to become a bodybuilder, for example, he efforts, he works hard, he practices exercise, and after that, when he achieves that goal and his body is gained this strength and power, he becomes happy.
Yes.
The kind of fulfillment which he's come to physically. And same thing happens in spiritual and
intellectual aspect. Yeah, but still, this is the question. What type of happiness is this? I mean, is this type of happiness a kind of...
It's internal peace.
Internal peace, that's
right. No, when we talk about the happiness, it's the peace. Basically, when your soul is happy, we feel peaceful.
Oh.
And today we can see that this is the biggest issue in the whole world. People go for yoga. People eat a lot of chocolates.
Yeah.
They have a lot of stress. Okay. They're taking, you know, these medications for all these things in order to have
And meditations, peace. Of course.
But and they do not have that peace.
Yes.
Today, world is after peace.
Oh.
You know, this peace which we talk
internal
about,
peace,
it's,
that's
it's because, you know, the meaning of spirituality in the Judaism, Christianity and Islam, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
They both religions, they have different meanings.
Yes.
Islam has the complete meaning of spirituality in its complete way or its original sense is in Islam, which gives you that peace, that happiness. Because since you have peace, then you have happiness. You feel happy. Even, you know, we have examples that one person who is in complete peace, spiritual, in the spiritual peace, like Lady Zainab Salamu Alayha, when Yazid says, when Ibn Ziyad has said, how did you say, saw what we have did to you? She said, Ma ra'aytu illa jamila. I haven't seen anything except beauty. So this beauty, how someone can say this? It's because of that inner peace. It's because this person has reached to the peaks of the perfection. And now they're peaceful. These hardships in this world, or maybe losing a life or losing anything, it does not takes you away from the right path. That's so because since you have reached to the God, then obviously you have the peace.
Another point regarding the happiness. There is a difference between, even in the, returning once more again to the philosophy, there is a difference between the happiness and joy. Happiness is like sa'ada. It's more ingrained in your soul. It's something that, that remains with you. Like, it's not just a joy which comes and goes. No. Happiness is sa'ada. It's translated like sa'ada. It's something that remains with you for all the time. So that's why one of the philosophers says, how we know that some person is happy? He said, we cannot know this in his life. We'll know this after when he dies. If when we look at his whole life, if he lived according to the excellence, then he is happy. So this is what Aristotle says, that if you want to know if someone is happy or not, look at his whole life. And you cannot know, and this is very much related to the Islamic thought of sa'ada. You cannot know someone is sa'id when he is alive. Maybe in the last moment he will change. So,
and necessarily not everybody who is joyful is happy.
Happy is something very... I will add more and say that maybe some person who is in hardship, you feel that he's in hardship, but inner, in deepest his soul, he's happy. He's feeling sa'ada, that I'm on the right path. His consciousness is very contented with the situation he's feeling inside him.
And this peace of soul is one of the main achievements of the holy month of Ramadan, which has to kept alive after the holy month of Ramadan too. That's all right. Thank you very much. I think that fasting, thawm, as we say in Farsi, ruze, and the holy month of Ramadan, is a concept that can make all Muslims around the world united again. You know, Eid al-Fitr is also a day that can make all the people united again, regardless of the color, faith, you know, sectarian look or denomination. And I think this is the best chance and opportunity for the Muslims to sit together, talk, establish dialogue, and on these specific, you know, common grounds and common pillars that they have, whether it be from a Sunni brethren or the Shia brethren. Okay. It was very kind of you, Brother Sajjad Haida. Thank you much for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, thank you very much, brother.
You're welcome.
It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Shia and Call of Islam page. May Allah accept all your supplications and your fasting during this holy month of Ramadan. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين مرحبا بالتائبين مرحبا بالعابدين في صلاة الخاشعين في رحاب الذاكرين رمضان 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 القانتين
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For the last two decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world to help conduct its global war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Nick Terse, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Global Drone War Has Killed Untold Numbers of Civilians, Including Children. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Libya has also been a long-time proving ground for new forms of air war. In November 1911, 107 years of the month before that drone attack killed Nasser Musa Abdullah, Italian Lieutenant Gavotti conducted the world's first modern airstrike. "Today I have decided to try to throw bombs from the aeroplane," he wrote in a letter to his father, while deployed in Libya to fight forces loyal to the Ottoman Empire. "I take the bomb with my right hand, pull off the security tack, and throw the bomb out, avoiding the wing," he said. Gavotti not only pioneered the idea of launching air raids on troops far from the traditional front lines of a war, but also targeting civilian infrastructure when he bombed an oasis that served as a social and economic center. As Thomas Hippler put it in his book Governing from the Skies, Gavotti introduced aerial attacks on hybrid targets that indefinitely and indifferently mingled civilian and military objectives. More than a century later, in 2016, Operation Odyssey, lightning again made Libya ground zero for testing of new air war concepts. In this case, airborne combat involving multiple drones working in combination with local troops and U.S. Special Operations Forces. As one of the drone pilots involved was quoted as saying in an Air Force news release, "Some of the tactics were created and some of the persistent attack capabilities that hadn't been used widely before were developed because of this operation." According to Colonel Case Cunningham, commander of the 432nd Expeditionary Wing at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, the headquarters of the Air Force's drone operations, about 70% of the MQ-9 Reaper drone strikes conducted during Odyssey lightning were close air support missions backing up local Libyan forces engaged in a street-to-street combat. The drones, he reported, often worked in tandem with one another, as well as with Marine Corps attack helicopters and jets, helping guide the airstrikes of those conventional aircraft. Despite hundreds of attacks in support of the Libyan Government of National Accord, the employment of U.S. proxies in counterterrorism missions combat by American commandos, and more than $850 million in U.S. assistance since 2011, Libya remains one of the most fragile states on Earth. Earlier this year, Biden renewed its national emergency status, first invoked by President Barack Obama in 2011. Civil conflict in Libya will continue until Libyans resolve their political divisions and foreign military intervention ends, wrote Biden, failing to mention the U.S. foreign military intervention there, including that November 2018 airstrike. The situation in Libya continues to pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. In early 2021, the Biden administration imposed limits on drone strikes and commando raids outside of conventional war zones while launching a review of all such missions and began writing a new playbook to govern counterterrorism operations. More than a year later, the results or lack thereof have yet to be made public. In January, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin directed subordinates to draw up a civilian harm mitigation and response plan within 90 days. That, too, has yet to be released. Until the Defense Department overhauls its airstrikes policy, civilians will continue to die in attacks. The U.S. military has a systematic targeting problem that will continue to cost civilians their lives, said Mark Garsalo, formerly the Pentagon's chief of high-value targeting in charge, that is, of the effort to kill Iraqi autocrat Saddam Hussein in 2003. And now the military advisor for PACS, a Dutch civilian protection organization. Civilian deaths are not discrete events. They are symptoms of larger problems such as a lack of proper investigations, a faulty collateral damage estimation methodology, over-reliance on intelligence without considering open-source data, and a policy that does not recognize the presumption of civilian status, unquote. Such larger problems have been revealed again and again. Last March, for example, the Yemen-based group Matana for Human Rights released a report examining 12 U.S. attacks in Yemen, 10 of them airstrikes, between January 2017 and January 2019. Its researchers found that at least 38 Yemeni non-combatants had been killed and 7 others injured in those attacks. A June 2021 Pentagon report on civilian casualties did acknowledge one of those incidents, the death of a civilian in Al Baida, Yemen, on January 22, 2019. Matwana's investigation determined that the attack killed Saleh Ahmed Mohammed Al-Ghaisi, a 67-year-old farmer who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. The U.S. had previously acknowledged 4 to 12 civilian deaths in a raid by Navy SEALs on January 29, 2017, also chronicled by Matwana. Through it reported a high death toll. As for the remaining allegations, Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the West Asia region, told Matwana in an April 2021 letter that it was confident that each airstrike hit its intended Al-Qaeda targets and nothing else. Rigorous investigative reporting by the New York Times on the last U.S. drone strike of the Afghan war in August 2021 forced an admission from the Pentagon. what General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had originally deemed a righteous strike had actually killed 10 civilians, 7 of them children. A subsequent Times investigation revealed that the 2019 U.S. air strike in Baghouz, Syria, had killed up to 64 non-combatants, a toll previously obscured through a multi-layered cover-up. The Times followed that up with an investigation of 1,300 reports of civilian casualties in Iraq and Syria, demonstrating, wrote reporter Azmat Khan, that the American air war in those countries was marked by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and often imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children, a sharp contrast to the American government's image of war waged by all-seeing drones and precision bombs. Since the Sirte campaign ended in late 2016, U.S. attacks in Libya have slowed considerably. AFRICOM conducted 7 declared airstrikes there in 2017, 6 in 2018, 4 in 2019, and none since. But the U.S. military has made little effort to re-evaluate past strikes and the civilian casualties they caused, including the November 2018 attack that killed Nasser Musa Abdullah. U.S. Africa Command followed the civilian casualty assessment process in place at the time and determined that the reports were unsubstantiated, said AFRICOM spokesperson Kelly Callan. Despite the criminal complaint filed on April 1st, the command is not re-examining the case. There is nothing new or different regarding the November 30, 2018 airstrike, Callan told reporters by email. Africa Command has clearly moved on, but Abdullah can't. Memories of his brother and those charred bodies are irrevocably lodged in his mind, but get caught in his throat. He says, I was in shock. He told reporters when discussing the phone call that preceded his dash across the desert. I'm so sorry, but I can't explain in words what I felt. Abdullah was similarly stuck when he attempted to describe the grisly scene that greeted him hours later. He was eloquent in speaking about the justice he seeks and how being branded a terrorist robbed his brother and their community of dignity. But of his final memory of Nasser, there is simply nothing that can be said. Not by him anyway. What I was seeing was so terrible. He told reporters, his voice rising, racked and loaded with pain, adding, I can't even describe it.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.